Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week, we read the short but radiant chapter, Isaiah 61, where the text walks with us incrementally from the indignities of captivity, whether economic, spiritual, or deep in our own bodies, through freedom and clear into glory and splendor. We imagine a jubilee that can reset the ever-growing avalanche of injustices in our world and envision ourselves as the people who serve those who have been held captive. I also imagined some kind of bizarre armed robbery wherein the robber wields a charred cow as a weapon. Wait, you didn't see that in the text? Thanks for being with us. Hello, Bobby. How are you today?
I'm good, Amy. How are you?
I am doing all right. I'm doing all right.
Say it often enough and it will be true.
That's right. If you say it three times and click your heels together, then you will be totally
suddenly
all
the
right.
World is technicolor.
I know. Yeah. So this is the current debate in my household, to let you know the state of our being, our well-being or not so well-being.
Yeah.
Okay, ready? So we watch movies on Saturday night. We have family movie night. And this week we watched Men in Black.
Yeah.
And the current family debate is whether I, the matriarch of the family,
yeah,
am more like Will Smith, which is clearly the right answer, or the guy who's like this giant cockroach alien stuffed into a farmer's body.
Oh, I know. I love that guy. You're totally like that guy. Is the debate between, like, you think you're Will Smith and your whole family thinks you're cockroach guy? Or is it is there like a division in the rest of the family?
I think I'm like a blend.
Oh, okay.
A blend of Will Smith and cockroach guy.
I can see that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can see that. Yeah, yeah. So this week we are in Isaiah chapter 61.
Yes.
All of it, although that's only 11 verses.
Right.
We have read from Isaiah before. We read Isaiah chapter 6. But Isaiah chapter 61 is a pretty different kind of text.
Yeah.
So can you orient us a little bit for what we're about to read today?
Sure. Yeah. The book of Isaiah, as you know, is usually thought of being in three different kind of historical settings. The Isaiah we read last time in Isaiah 6 is from the 8th century. The second part of Isaiah comes right at the end of the exile, probably written from Babylon in around 540. The third part of Isaiah, where we are today, is slightly later even than that. It's dated usually between the time that people start returning to the land around 520 down to sometime in the period of, say, Ezra and Nehemiah in 450. And so that's where we are today, is in Isaiah 61, that the exile is, you know, somewhere between, say, 25 and 75 years in the past. People are kind of trickling back to the land, I would guess, from the exile in Babylon. And this text is written from the perspective either of those who have returned from the exile or those who were never exiled and are sort of, you know, still in the land, welcoming people back.
Yeah.
It's worth remembering, like, sometimes when I talk about the exile, I think of, like, they went into exile and then they came home. And it's like, you know, they were gone for a while. But, you know, they've been gone for somewhere on the order of 100 years by this point. And so we're a couple generations removed from the people who actually went into the exile. So the people went into exile and then some of the people went home. But they are the grandchildren or maybe the great-grandchildren even of the people who actually had ever lived in the land.
Right.
What else would you want to say about this text by way of historical context? Anything?
The only thing that I might add is that I think, tell me if you agree with this, I think 3rd Isaiah generally is sort of less interested in the idea of reestablishing a Davidic king
that's right.
as the path forward, whereas a lot of other, you know, authors have really held that as this is going to be the way out. This is what we need. We need a Davidic king. Trito Isaiah's not that interested in that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right, which is kind of ironic because this passage that we're going to read today is one of the passages that very much is, like, this is the passage that Jesus reads in the synagogue in Luke 4 that then heralds his whole ministry. He's like, look, I'm that guy. So this text becomes a messianic text in the mouth of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke. But I think you're right that this part of Isaiah is not as interested in that sort of messianic idea. He's more interested in the community as a whole.
Okay, so we are in Isaiah chapter 61, and I am reading from the NJPS. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me as a herald of joy to the humble, to bind up the wounded of heart, to proclaim release to the captives, liberation to the imprisoned, to proclaim a year of the Lord's favor, and a day of vindication by our God, to comfort all who mourn, to provide for the mourners in Zion, to give them a turban instead of ashes, the festive ointment instead of mourning, a garment of splendor instead of a drooping spirit. They shall be called terebinths of victory, planted by the Lord for his glory. And they shall build the ancient ruins, raise up the desolations of old, and renew the ruined cities, the desolations of many ages. God has sent me as a herald of joy to the humble. This is so different than Isaiah's call in chapter 6.
Yeah.
Isaiah was not going to be a herald of joy to the humble.
No. I the whole time I'm reading this passage, I'm thinking back to Isaiah 6. And I don't know that I would have done that just sort of normally reading Isaiah, but the fact that the narrative lectionary has had us so recently in Isaiah 6 and then has us here.
Yeah.
And that the herald of joy as opposed to the herald of destruction in Isaiah 6.
Yeah.
That whole conversation.
I would much rather be this herald. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. If you got to be a herald, like, this is the herald to be.
So one of the first metaphors we see is this idea of releasing the captives.
Yeah.
And so one of my first exercises as a reader is to try to really inhabit that metaphor and think about what the different resonances of it are.
Yeah.
And where I went in reading this text was this sense that as a person who is being held captive, you know that there is a life out there, that there is goodness out there in the world. You're aware of it, but you can't access it.
Yeah.
So I wonder if this is talking about the experience of the people who have been in Zion the whole time, mm-hmm. or the people who have been exiled to Babylon. I mean, in some ways, the experience of the people who were not exiled was probably worse.
I think that, I mean, that's an interesting question. And honestly, you know, as you're saying that, like, I could think of this from both perspectives and it kind of makes sense. And I kind of like that because now we don't have to, like, play into the binary of who went and who stayed. We can say this was an experience of exile, you know, from which one is grateful to be released. Sort of no matter whether you were actually in the exile or whether you stayed in the land. Like, the community has been devastated and it is, it's been a struggle. There has been a trauma that has happened and it has been a struggle to recover. And this is proclaiming release from that.
And it's doing it in very specific terms or terms that have a specific resonance for me.
Yeah.
This phrase in verse 1, to proclaim release of the captives, sounds to me like the Jubilee year.
In the NRSV, to proclaim liberty to the captives, release to the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Like, those three together are kind of screaming Jubilee to me, too. Can you talk a little bit about what the year of Jubilee is in the Torah?
Sure. So in Leviticus, it's in chapter 25, we read about this thing called the Jubilee year, which is every 50 years. And in verse 10 in chapter 25, it says, you shall hallow the 50th year. Each of you shall return to his holding, and each of you shall return to his family. So there is a sense that if in the course of time, for example, you have gone into debt or have become a servant, like an indentured servant, maybe, every 50 years, it's like the clock resets and everyone goes back to their original position.
Yeah.
Which is not to say you're going to stay there forever, but you don't wind up, indentured servitude doesn't become a permanent state for you and your descendants.
So yeah, so that's a beautiful idea. And so and when you read it in this context, like, I think it still works on the personal level. Like, we're imagining a place where people who have become impoverished, or people who have had to sell themselves into slavery or indentured servitude are going to be restored. And mm-hmm. also, we're thinking about the people of Israel as a whole who have had their land taken by the nations. And now, I mean, it's not exactly 50 years, but it's 50 years-ish they've yeah. been in the exile. And now the land is restored to them. And so this is that jubilee on that sort of communal sense. This land that you lost is you are now restored to your rightful holding. Mm-hmm. And so I love that, this kind of frames both the like the thought of individual economic justice on the one hand, and also the sort of communal restoration on the other hand, all through that lens yeah. of that Jubilee text.
Yeah, I really like the connection to the Jubilee and the way that it lays out this possibility that there is some underlying truth that carries through the generations. Yeah. And the reality in the moment can indeed meander from that, yeah. but it will reset back to that state yeah. periodically.
Yeah. No, I like that a lot. One of the things that's important to me here is that this prophet is speaking to the oppressed and the brokenhearted and the captives and the prisoners. And I think is speaking as an oppressed, brokenhearted, captive prisoner. Like, this is a text that is proclaiming our release from captivity. Not when, you know, when I read this text as a middle-class person in the U.S., like, my natural orientation is I'm not a captive. And so I am sort mm-hmm. of bestowing, like, release upon people who mm-hmm. are captives. And I mean, that's a fine way to read it. But I think in its original writing, this text is written from the perspective of people who are or have been captives themselves. And so this is the sort of, this is good news for us.
Right.
Which is going to become important in a little bit in my own interpretation. But I think it's a helpful perspective, just A, to say that. And then B, to say, for many of us, people positioned in society like I am, we're having to do some work in order to figure out how to find ourselves in this text. Because I'm not sure this text is actually for people who are positioned in a way of privilege like someone like me might be.
So as the text goes on, we move from this metaphor of captives and the release of captives to the metaphor of mourners.
Yeah.
How do you feel the relationship between verses 1 and 2 and then verse 3 where we're talking about mourners and their transition into joy?
Yeah, it is interesting that, you know, the prophet has said, God has anointed me to do the following things, right? To bring good news, to bind up, to proclaim liberty and release, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, to comfort all who mourn, to provide for those who mourn. Mm-hmm. And then we get in sort of this description of those who mourn. So that's sort of a transition point in the text. It focuses on these mourners and it mentions them twice. So I think it's interesting in this text that, you know, we have this sort of economic language, but then we also have this emotive language of those who mm-hmm. mourn because of those things, but also maybe those who mourn are also being proclaimed release for, or those who are mourning are also being comforted here. I think that's kind of an interesting move on the part of this prophet.
No, I like that a lot. And I want to note first how much I appreciate that you sort of diagrammed this sentence for us, because it's really, it's easy to lose track of the fact that all of these infinitives are following, this is what the speaker has come to do.
Yeah.
So that's really helpful.
And then you get this series of instead ofs. So you get a garland, or your translation was a turban, I think.
I got a turban.
Yeah.
Instead of ashes. Sounds really different.
Gladness instead of mourning. Praise instead of a faint spirit. And so you've got this sense that this proclamation the prophet is doing is taking one kind of thing and turning it into another kind of thing. There's a replacement that's happening here where these mm-hmm. things that are marked as, I think, negative are being replaced mm-hmm. by things marked as positive. What does that mean, do you think, a turban or a garland instead of ashes?
I see each of these instead ofs as a way of getting back to this really essential human experience, I would say, of the dignity of inhabiting our bodies.
Mm.
And when the dignity of the body is being respected and even elevated and honored, and when it's not, and when it's intentionally not. And so, you know, the experience of captives is often that their body is not honored and they have no autonomy over their body.
I love that.
And the mourner intentionally sort of is commanded in other parts of the biblical text to don't know what the word is, not debase their body in some way as a way of expressing their distress, their mourning.
Yeah.
And this is very intentional, like embodied actions to elevate the body back up, you know, a turban or a garland instead of ashes. You know, don't put ashes in your hair like a mourner would. Yeah. Instead, put something on your head that honors you.
Yeah.
It's interesting how embodied these actions are to me.
The other thing that I like here, and I'm just sort of paying attention to it now, is that, like, the prophet is not telling them they ought to do these things. The prophet is actually commanded to give them these things.
Yeah.
So the prophet is saying, here's your turban, here's your oil of gladness, here is your mantle of praise, which I like. Like, sometimes the, like, hey, y'all, time to praise can feel a little onerous to me. Yeah. Like, I'm in a hard place and you're telling me I need to praise.
Right.
But here it is, the prophet is actually enabling that in some very direct, tangible way.
And then it moves on from the body in verse 4, or us humans as embodied spirits, to the city and sort of the rebuilding the dignity of the city, which, I don't know, what do you think about that move?
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, there's so much resonance there, I think, from the ancient world until the modern world about the devastation of cities and the restoration of those. I mean, I think in the first instance, this is a reference to the destruction of Jerusalem and Judea at the hands of the Babylonians. Mm-hmm. And so here there's a call to restore the ancient places and to instead of now having to live amongst the rubble, we can restore and renew the places where we live. And so that continues this kind of embodiedness that you're talking about. Like, you've got to wear things and you've got to live in places. And so we need to, first we restore the way our bodies are and what we're wearing. Then we restore the places that we live. And so we can have a place that conveys our restoration and not continue to live as though we are oppressed and captive.
Yeah. I love that.
What do you think about that restoring of ruined cities?
I mean, I love what you're saying. I like you, I think, see this just as a continued expansion out of the same movement.
Yeah.
You know, that care for the dignity of the human and the body and the spaces that it inhabits. And also, cities in particular evoke for me sort of the question of pride. Like, we can feel proud of which I guess pride is really just a continuation of dignity if you keep going down the continuum, but it's something that other people can see and can see that you care, that you are cared for, or that you care about your spaces and you have the will and the ability to build them up.
Yeah, I like that. And the other place that you're making me think with this is, like, you could think of those wearing of festive garments of praise as an individual thing. Like, I individually am going to take care of myself. Mm-hmm. But this, like, and then now also we're going to restore our cities has a very clear communal aspect to it. So it's not enough for me to put off mourning and be given this kind of celebratory appearance, but for the whole community, like, I need to be part of that communal restoration too.
I love that. And I love that. I love it.
The other piece that's here is this, they will be called oaks of righteousness and the planting of the Lord.
Yeah.
And I just, that's just such a hopeful image of the, we're not a seed anymore. We're not a stump anymore. Now we are like we're a mighty oak, and we display the glory of the Lord. Like, that's just such a refreshing image after the images that we've seen elsewhere in Isaiah of the destruction of the plant world. And now here we have, like, the mighty oak as the sort of crowning glory in some kind of way of the people of God.
Yes. I love it. So pressing forward, let's pick up in verse 5. Strangers shall stand and pasture your flocks. Aliens shall be your plowmen and vine trimmers, while you shall be called priests of the Lord and termed servants of our God. You shall enjoy the wealth of nations and revel in their riches. Because your shame was double, men cried, disgrace is their portion. Assuredly, they shall have a double share in the land. Joy shall be theirs for all time. Okay, I have a question for you about this first image.
Yeah.
So do you read this as sort of a peaceful cohabitation of peoples, or as a other people will do your chores for you?
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is a problematic part of this text. And, like, I get where it's coming from, but I think it needs some contextualizing. I do not read it as a peaceful coexistence, exactly. Mm-hmm. I read it not necessarily as, like, a oppressive relationship either, but what it seems to be saying to me is, you, people of Judah, are going to be a spiritual nation, and your job is going to be the things of the Spirit. And there are going to be other people from other places who are going to do your labor for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they're not necessarily being forced to labor for you, but you don't have to do your own work because somebody else is going to do it. And so there is a, like, we have just gotten out of this sort of image of, like, restoring people from economic oppression. And then almost immediately, we've just envisioned a new relationship mm-hmm. where there's at least some economic oppression or at least economic privilege.
Yeah.
The way that I make sense of this is that, you know, this is sort of what the people have been. I mean, I think one way of processing what the exile has been like is that the people of Judah have been exiled away from their land. They've been working someone else's land. The nations have been taking advantage of them. And mm-hmm. so this is a word of comfort. If you've been through that, now we're going to flip the tables a little bit. And other people, the nations are going to do that for you now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe we could imagine a better possibility, like we're all going to, you know, live on a kibbutz together.
Yeah.
We're all going to do our part.
Right.
Yeah. But maybe it's a little early to expect a people who's been sort of living in a situation mm-hmm. of exile for a century to mm-hmm. suddenly be able to get all the way there. But this image of reversal, I think, is maybe a step on that way.
Yeah.
What do you think
about that? No, I think that makes sense. And I think what you're saying fits in really well with the last part we just read in verse 7, that disgrace had been their portion, and now they get to move all the way to sort of the opposite. You know, as much disgrace as you had, that much joy you will have. You know, there is a sense of, like, balancing it out from one extreme to the other.
I think that's right. So double shame becomes double portion. Earlier, when I was talking about how it's important that we remember that this text is written from the perspective of people who themselves have been oppressed, this is partly what I was talking about.
Yeah.
Is that for somebody who was, like, middle class person, you know, the notion that someone else will work for you has a very different resonance than it does if you have just come out of a situation where you have been working on for someone else and now you're going to get to rest a little bit. And so we who read from a position of privilege, and I count myself certainly amongst that group, need to be careful what we do with this text. I think we would envision ourselves maybe actually as being the laborers in this thing.
Like, yes.
We who have been having other people work for our benefit now are going to have to turn around and work for their benefit.
Yes. No, I think that's such an important point. So moving on then to verse 8. For I, the Lord, love justice. I hate robbery with a burnt offering. I will pay them their wages faithfully and make a covenant with them for all time. Their offspring shall be known among the nations, their descendants in the midst of the peoples. All who see them shall recognize that they are a stock the Lord has blessed. That line in verse 8 just cracks me up every time I read it. I hate robbery with a burnt offering. Is that like with a fiery passion? Like, or like... like, do you use, like, is the burnt offering your weapon? Like, you throw a charred cow at someone to distract you?
Hey, you. Like, I guess a charred cow doesn't moo, though, does it? At least I hope not.
Robbery. I hate it when people rob me using with a burnt offering.
I hate robbery with a burnt offering. In my mind, there's two ways of dealing with that issue. One is, if you preserve your translation, it puts me in the mindset of Amos. And as you know, in Amos, the people are, on the one hand, like, taking garments in pledge, and on the other hand, coming to the temple to make their offerings.
That is such a more spiritual reading than throwing a charred cow at someone to steal their jewelry. I know.
Yeah. So I think if you read it that way, it's a little bit like, hey, don't come to the temple with your things taken illegally and try to offer me offerings.
Yeah.
The NRSV actually reads, I hate robbery and wrongdoing. And I think they're reading, instead of Ola, I think they're reading, I don't know if it's Ivla, maybe Avla. I don't know quite what the noun is.
Mm-hmm.
But they're reading, they're doing a little bit of a textual emendation there to get to robbery and wrongdoing.
Yeah.
We should say, I think that, so up until this verse, the prophet has been talking and suddenly God is talking. I, the Lord, love justice.
Yes.
And so the deity has sort of stepped in to take control of the discourse here.
Yeah, and there really is a sense in what the deity is saying, I will pay them their wages faithfully.
Yes.
That, you know, this is coming right from that section where it said, you know, disgrace had been their portion. It's gone all the way from disgrace to this double portion of joy. And so there is there's a sense that all that there's a fairness underlying this system. And if you think of the quote unquote wages that God pays you, you know, you get your just desserts.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think that's right. But I also think that, you know, there's no reason we couldn't also read this as God is going to ensure the fairness of the economic system, too, like quite concretely. Mm. And mm-hmm. I think that might be part of that we could read here as well. Because God has just said, I love justice, right? And so yes. Justice is imagining or envisioning this sort of economic, among other things, is envisioning economic justice for everybody.
Yeah, which ties really nicely back to the Jubilee, which we started with.
That's exactly right, yeah.
You know, that is the foundation of economic justice.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. What do you think of the fact that then in verse 9, we sort of go on to the idea of being known among the peoples, like yeah. this sort of yet further elevated sense of pride and reputation?
In my mind, that builds on the the last line of verse 9, I will make an everlasting covenant with them. And in my mind, that's what the other people among the nations look and say, ah, there's this prosperous group of people mm-hmm. who have a just mm-hmm. society. Their God is faithful to them, unyieldingly so. And that's going to be a point of pride for the people, is this covenant that they have with Yahweh that I think organizes their life in a just way that other people mm-hmm. notice.
I love that connection that you just made, sort of reading the end of verse 8 together with verse 9. I think that grounds it really nicely in the biblical tradition. And just looking at the progression within this chapter, if we start with, you know, freedom and sort of autonomy, some kind of self-determination that comes with being released from captivity, to this dignity of the body, to, you know, dignity of the city and rebuilding, to the opportunity to do meaningful work and serve God. And then this is the sort of crowning glory, in some way, splendor, the thought that others will recognize the wholeness of this system is also a really common biblical trope. Like, we want other yeah. people to see the glory of our God and our relationship to our God by seeing the wholeness in this system.
I love that. That is so well said. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, the last couple of verses of this chapter, starting in verse 10. I greatly rejoice in the Lord. My whole being exults in my God, for he has clothed me with garments of triumph, wrapped me in a robe of victory, like a bridegroom adorned with a turban, like a bride bedecked with her finery. For as the earth brings forth her growth and a garden makes the seed shoot up, so the Lord God will make victory and renown shoot up in the presence of all the nations.
I love that imagery so much. And it brings together those kind of two main metaphors that we've been talking about. One is what the person is wearing, and the changing of, you know, mourning and sadness mm-hmm. into this mm-hmm. clothing of joy. And this gets even more amplified here. And then you also get the yes. image of the plants shooting forth. I just love it. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, no, yes, here clearly clothing of honor. It's like everything has been amped up from what it was before.
Yeah.
And I love that connection back to the terebinths in verse 3, the terebinths of victory that now come to be victory and renown shoot up in the presence of all the nations. It's a really nice sort of capstone to all the messages of this chapter. Just
yeah.
everything is the volume's brought up even a little bit higher.
The other thing that I love here is, so, you know, this is the images of a bridegroom dressing for the marriage and then the bride dressing for the marriage. And so this is not, like, before you had a sense of, like, you're going to put off your mourning and you're going to be able to wear, like, regular clothes of everyday folks. Mm-hmm. Now you're going to dress the way that people dress on their wedding day. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just going to be an everyday thing. It's going to be, you're going to be in your wedding finery every day. And
yes.
that clothing is salvation and righteousness. I love that image. We've gone from mourning to everyday clothes to wedding clothes.
And then I love that these last couple of verses pull together that idea of victory that we see early in this chapter. They shall be called terebinths of victory, comes back in verse 11,
yeah.
victory. And then also renown,
yeah.
which we just talked about, the role of renown in the possibility of spiritual transformation for other nations that are looking at you and sort of looking to your example.
This plant metaphor at the end, So I have become accustomed to thinking of the plants as being the people, right? So either the people are getting cut back to a stump or the people are becoming a terebinth.
But
here, like the shoots that spring up in a garden, so the Lord will cause righteousness and praise to spring up before all the nations. It's almost like God has planted a praise garden, and so the nations can walk by and be like, wow, look at that praise garden.
I'm really glad you pointed out that distinction here. And I think that for me, it sort of, it completes this picture of the lives of the individual Israelites or Judeans as symbols of this, of God's victory. And so, I mean, in some ways, I think it can be both.
Yeah.
You know, that yes, indeed, it is, you know, earlier it says, they, the people, shall be called terebinths of victory.
Yeah.
So the people are the terebinths, but also the terebinths represent victory.
Yeah.
All right, Bobby. This is a beautiful chapter.
It's a beautiful text. I love this
one. And rich, very rich with metaphors. What would you pull out for our communities today?
I love this text. And, you know, in thinking about where it resonates with me, I want to go all the way back to the beginning and this initial message about good news to the oppressed, the binding up of the brokenhearted, liberty to the captives, release to the prisoners, the year of the Lord's favor. And at its core, what this text is about is those people who have been treated unjustly are going to be restored so that they will be treated justly and they'll be able to live like full lives as full members of the community. And we're not only going to restore justice, but we're going to restore joyfulness, and we're going to restore not just people, but we're going to restore communities. Cities are going to be rebuilt. Like there is this bringing together of spiritual things, economic justice, the rebuilding of cities, the thriving of communities, and then ultimately that becomes a model or an inspiration to the people all around. It's just such a beautiful idea that is rooted in the restoration of justice to people who have been treated unjustly. And I just think that resonates so clearly with our current moment, right? If we could figure out a way to restore justice to those who have been treated unjustly, and the poor, the oppressed, the captive, and rebuild our communities in ways that include all of those folks as full and equal members of community, that not only would we be better off, but also we would be a model of what is possible the faith communities can model that for the rest of the world by saying, yes, within our communities, we're going to find ways to establish these communities of justice that draw the attention of people all around who say, wow, look what you can do in the name, yes, of God, if you focus on justice.
Yes.
So I think that's,
I love that.
Lovely.
I love that. That's beautiful. And I, you know, this text got me thinking in interesting ways, maybe just because of the moment we're in our own sort of national history or world history, about the Jubilee and, you know, this, and sort of like, what if we did have something like that? And was there in some period of time a just distribution of resources that we can get back to, or was it never just? Would it just be perpetuating a different uneven I don't know the answer to that question, but what an incredible idea to both acknowledge that wealth does transfer between households and families for real reasons, but there can be a resetting so it doesn't sort of it doesn't continue to avalanche down the mountain such that over the course of many generations, the differential is so extreme that it seems insurmountable, which is in a lot of ways where we are now.
Yeah.
I think we have avalanched.
That's right. And I appreciate your calling it back to that, like the fundamentally economic language, nature of this language, drawing on that debt model of Leviticus 25. Mm-hmm. And the impression that you get is that this prophet is not declaring one time Jubilee, but in fact is saying this new covenant that God is making with the people is itself Jubilee. And so debt relationships need to be restructured in perpetuity. And that is certainly not where we find ourselves right now.
The other thing that I'm really appreciating about this text right now is the way that it starts the restoration with the dignity of the body.
Yes.
and thinking very concretely about the moment that we're in. And I know in my community, people are suffering tremendously from the isolation
yes.
that they're experiencing during the pandemic, you know? And I have to ask myself almost daily now whether I think such and such is safe because I am tired of the pandemic or because I actually have reason to believe yeah. it's safe to do. Sometimes all one can do in that experience is to take it way back down to care for the body. Like what can we do to care for our bodies through this really difficult time to move us one step removed from mourning, just one step removed.
Yeah.
And then sort of see what comes next and hope that it will, you know, of course, builds to this much more beautiful moment of release and honor and glory. But that, I don't know, the concreteness of the movement from mourning and captivity towards something else feels helpful to me right now.
I love that both on the sort of spiritual level and also on the sort of economic, political level, or however you want to think about that, that all of this grand vision begins with the bodies of individual people, that's the root dignity that then moves to the communal dignity, which then moves to the people like the as a whole's dignity, which then inspires the world. But it all starts with the body. I love that.
Yeah.
When you read this text, of course, in a Christian tradition, and especially we're reading this on the third Sunday of Advent, I should mention probably just as a interpreter from the Christian perspective that this passage gets pulled in Luke chapter 4 when Jesus announces his ministry. He reads the first part of Isaiah 61 and he says, it closes the scroll and says, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing," by which he means this is about me. Now, the text does not obviously have to be read that way, but Jesus picks up this text as a way of framing what his ministry is about. And so in a very direct way, and I think in a way that's appropriate to Advent, as Christian readers anticipate the arrival of Jesus in a couple of weeks at Christmas, to remember that this is the fundamentals about what Jesus said his ministry is about, is this restoration of dignity and justice that we've been talking about. One cannot be a Christian and avoid the vision of this passage because Jesus does not allow it to be avoided. And so Christmas ought to be putting us, Advent ought to be putting us squarely in conversations about economic justice, which is not where we normally go in Advent
that's
or Christmas.
Not my association.
Yeah, at all. Yeah. And when the nations look at Christians at Christmas, what do they see? And it is not economic justice, then we're doing something wrong and we need to straighten up.
Strong words.
Speaking of Luke, next week we are moving into the Gospel of Luke, where we will
be
for the rest of the year. I mean, the rest of the season. So until May.
Leolamba Ed, forever and ever. Yeah. Yeah.
And so next week we'll be in Luke chapter 1, verses 26 to 45 and 46 to 56, which is the Annunciation of Mary and then the Magnificat.
All right. Well, I look forward to it.
I do too. Good to talk to you, Amy.
You too. Hope y'all have a good week.
See you next time.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/Bibleworm podcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We are grateful to all our supporters for helping us keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois.
Join us again next week when we'll be discussing Luke chapter 1. Until then, keep on digging.